announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Hey, welcome to another edition of the Filthy FRB Show. It's Saturday, August 15th. I'm joined, as always, by Filthy Tom Lawler. And today we welcome a leading authority on performance-enhancing drugs in the world of MMA. He has his own podcast called Pro MMA Radio, and he's a veteran journalist of the bodybuilding industry and also MMA. His name is Larry Pepe. What's up, Larry?
What's up, Brian? What's up, Tom?
Not much.
Well, listen, you may have left off what I'm hearing is my biggest accolade. If you're telling the truth, the episode I did is your most trafficked episode?
Yeah, it actually beat out the episode that we did with Brian Stan and also adult film star Nikki Benz, who has like a million Twitter followers. And the reason for that, Larry, it got picked up on a few of the websites because, you know, I was just describing you to a friend. I said, yeah, I got to do this podcast, or I'm going to do this podcast. And the reality of it is there's probably only two or three people in this entire industry who have the knowledge base to speak on this subject matter with any degree of intellect. Mm. You know?
I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why it got picked up. And, you know, people
Brian,
are sharing.
You were talking about me. Harry or me?
Well, Tom, you know less than me. And I don't even know anything.
That's true. Good point.
Yeah.
Continue well, on. Listen. If Herb Dean were here, he'd be stopping this already. So let's separate you guys and just let you go to your respective corners.
So let's bring people up to speed here. So this whole clusterfuck with Anderson Silva and the Nevada Athletic Commission, it starts January 9th. Give us the details, Larry.
Well, he tests positive for Dristanolone and Androstane. Of course, somehow that test never made its way to the Nevada State Athletic Commission in time to pull him from the fight with Nick Diaz. So they actually let him get in the cage loaded on performance-enhancing drugs, which raises its own set of issues and questions. We spoke on the last podcast when I came on that for Bennett, the executive director of the commission, to not have made sure and not have called. He said it was a busy week. For him to not have communicated with the testing facility, which was Smyrtle, and not get those results before letting Anderson get in the cage is despicable. And I'll use the word unbelievable. Then on January 19th, Anderson submits a clean sample. So he's apparently off everything at that time. But then on January 31st, on fight night, he tests positive again by the Smyrtle lab for Dristanolone, which was in the first positive test on January 9, and also for two benzo class drugs that are more like anti-anxiety, sleep, that type of thing. So not what we would put in the performance-enhancing drug class. But he popped for the Dristanolone both times on the 9th and the 31st, the Androstane on the 9th. And what's interesting, and we'll get into it in terms of his defense or lack thereof, is that on January 31st, on fight night, on the same night that Smyrtle tested him positive for Dristanolone, for some reason that only the Nevada State Athletic Commission could possibly explain because it is so stupid, they had Quest run a test on him that night as well. And my understanding is that test is literally minutes apart from when he gives his sample for the Smyrtle test. And the Quest test, here's the punchline, he's not on anything. The Quest test comes back clean. So you have Anderson Silva giving his urine sample on fight night minutes apart. One sample to Smyrtle, positive for Dristanolone. Another sample to Quest, negative for everything.
So post-fight, the Quest test did not even pick up the benzos that were taking. If Anderson's being truthful in his testimony, they were taken after the weigh-in.
Right. And the test, I have an actual picture of the test in front of me, and it says anabolic. Now, I don't know that they tested him for the benzo class of drugs, because what I have in front of me says anabolic agents, negative, masking agents, negative. Okay, that's as far as the test goes. Then it gives a long list of the different testosterones they tested for, the different clenbuterol, all the different things that were in there. And he's negative on everything. I don't know that Quest ran a test for the benzos. But his Quest test, literally, I'm looking at it right now, anabolic agents negative, masking agents negative. So my suspicion is, because this is the only sheet that I have, my suspicion is that they did not test him for those other classifications of drugs and that this was a straight PED test.
Yeah, Tom, I mean, can you think of any reason why you'd be using Quest Diagnostics and also Smyrtle, which for people that don't know is a sports medicine research and testing laboratory, why the need for two different organizations to test the samples?
Well, I don't know. I guess for like clarity's sake, I mean, if you have multiple testing, companies doing this stuff and they're both coming back with the same result, then it kind of gives you some affirmation. But in this case, or confirmation, in this case, they're conflicting, so it's a problem.
And here's where the problem is too, Brian. You're setting up a disaster. Like, I've never seen anybody do this. I've never seen two different labs being asked to test the same guy at the same time, because you're setting up this very scenario. The confirming result is supposed to be the first lab, Smyrtle, saving the B sample. That's how this is done. You don't bring in another company and set up a situation like this where you can have conflicting drug test results between two different companies, because now that raises the question of which one is right. Who did it right? Who did it wrong? Because either he has the stuff in his system or he doesn't. So one of these two companies was negligent. One of these two companies did something wrong, because it is impossible that the same human being can give a urine sample to each company within minutes and the drug be in one urine sample and not be in the other urine sample. And that's why you have B samples, because when an athlete appeals, they are supposed to be able to have access to demand that the B sample is tested as the confirming test. Now, here's the further irony. Guess who else had conflicting drug tests
at that
event? Correct. So you set up the situation twice. Now, Nick Diaz's was the opposite. He was negative for Smyrtle and positive for Quest. So it really turns into a debacle, and it makes zero. I mean, if there's a way to get to less than zero, that's where we are, in terms of how much sense it makes for the commission to be ordering drug tests from two different companies from the same athletes at the same time on the same night, especially when Smyrtle is the WADA-approved laboratory. You already have them involved. So it really, it should have been. A first-year law student would have made this, in my opinion, Anderson's entire defense. His entire defense. Forget about this ludicrous blue vial crap. Like, that's insanity. Like, that's worse than Overeem's defense.
Are you saying there's no way that this was the result of some Viagra from Thailand? Is that what you're telling me, Larry?
You know, I have never heard that Dristanolone is the active ingredient in Viagra or Cialis. So it is a little tough for me to believe. But, you know, look, on the flip side, Tom, to play devil's advocate, you know, professional athletes who know they're being subject to drug testing take liquids from people they know for a year in the gym locker room in an unmarked vial all the time. So I don't know why everybody's getting so crazy about this thing.
So, Larry, do you know the testing differences? Does Smyrtle use mass spectrometry, if I can say it right, mm-hmm. and the other one uses chromatography, whether it be gas or liquid? Do you?
To be perfectly honest, I don't know what their respective methodologies are.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's just I even Pat Lundvall, Commissioner Pat Lundvall, made a she alluded to the fact that they go about getting the test results in a different manner, and she seemed to lend more credence to the Smyrtle results.
Okay, so then somebody should have asked Pat Lundvall, the genius, why they ordered Quest in the first place. Like, if you believe that Smyrtle is your more sophisticated lab and you already have them running the tests, then why in the world are you asking Quest to do anything?
I think the answer that she gave was Quest is cheaper.
But you're already paying for Smyrtle.
That doesn't make any sense.
They've already been hired. It's not like you're saying, hey, which one should we go for? Or let's say you had Quest, right? And you believe that Quest is not as good at this as Smyrtle is. And you, let's say you have Vitor Belfort, who is a known cheater, who has gotten popped multiple times, who's coming off testosterone, and you're saying, you know what? For this fight, for this guy, we want the most sophisticated test that we can get. And yeah, Quest is already on board, but we want to bring Smyrtle in because we think they're more sophisticated. We think they do it better. It still is a slippery, slippery slope to start to go down, because if this happens, where you have conflicting results, now you have a mess on your hands. But at least logically, you might say, well, look, Smyrtle's WADA approved. You know, they're one of only two WADA labs in the United States, UCLA being the other one. Quest isn't. They know how to get into the nooks and crannies better. This is a known user. We're more suspicious of this individual. We want to make sure it's on the up and up. So even though Quest is already on board, now, Quest, the logical thing to do would be to say, hey, Quest, you can stay home for this one, and we're going to let Smyrtle do it. Or you don't have to test the main event because we have Smyrtle do it. But I could at least get, to some degree, the logic that you want to bring in the one you think is the heavier hitter. You already had the heavy hitter. You already had him. You already had Smyrtle there.
Sure.
Doing the testing. So why you would feel a need to bring in a cheaper, less sophisticated testing agency, by your words, is, again, it just has me sitting here shaking my head.
So, Larry, just to give the people an idea, why would Anderson Silva be taking drostanolone, a.k.a. Masterone, and then also methyl testosterone or androstane 17-diol?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we talked about this on the last podcast, that drostanolone is very popular with athletes who have to make weight, because when you take drostanolone, the street name is Masterone, that's how most people would know it. It is known as a hardening drug and a strength drug. But kind of the attraction for athletes who have to make weight is that it doesn't cause you to hold a lot of fluid. I use the example with Rampage Jackson, you know, when he was in, I believe it was Japan, and he didn't make weight, and it was like, I think, the first time in his entire career he didn't make weight. And he missed pretty badly, as I recall. I think he was around 211 or 212. And it later came out
when he fought Ryan Bader.
Right, when he fought Bader. And I believe it came out after that fight that he was on testosterone. Well, testosterone, while it has that strength-enhancing and muscle-enhancing quality, the negative for an athlete who has to make weight is that it will cause you to hold a fair amount of fluid, especially the first time you're on it, because your body is going to be a little more sensitive. It's going to be a little more surprised by its properties. And if you don't know that, if you're not being advised on that, and you don't change your diet and become very sensitive to fluid retention, I've seen people balloon up 20, 25 pounds in 6 or 8 weeks on testosterone because they didn't make those adjustments. With drostanolone, Masterone, you don't really have that issue because it gives you the strength that you would want as a fighter, but it doesn't bring with it that added fluid. In fact, it has a bit of a fat-cutting, hardening effect. That's why in the bodybuilding industry, you'll see athletes use Masterone, you know, maybe 4 to 6 weeks out from a contest, because they're already getting super lean, they're already getting very vascular, and it's not going to hold fluid, which is deathly to a bodybuilder, because if you're holding fluid, you can't see the definition and the clarity the same way. But it allows you to maintain your strength and has that cutting component. The Androstain is more of a strength component and muscle mass component. And Androstain will hold some fluid, which also makes the combination of Drostanolone and Androstain make even more sense, because Masterone has a little bit more of a cutting effect. It can limit the fluid that you might otherwise hold from the Androstain. So when you really look at the stack and you look at what he was caught on, from a standpoint of a fighter looking for strength, looking to not hold fluid, looking for some extra muscle, all that stuff, it kind of makes a whole lot of sense.
Now, Larry, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, Larry, you're talking about Masteron having a hardening effect. Isn't that essentially just what Anderson was looking for?
I knew that. I knew that was coming. I really did. I think he was looking for a different kind of hardening, if you believe his testimony. Of course, to believe his testimony, you were probably drinking at some point during the commission hearings.
Now, Larry, I did a little research on Androstain or methyl testosterone, and they said it's not going to give you a lot of lean muscle mass in a short period of time, but it will make you super aggressive, similar to like a halo testin or mm-hmm. check drops, something that would really help you if you're going to be in a scrap with a guy that wants to beat you up.
Yeah, I mean, look, really what it comes down to, Brian, is that, you know, you have androgenic drugs and anabolic drugs. And anabolic drugs are more healing in nature, and androgenic drugs are more strength, muscle mass, and accompanying aggression in some cases. I'm not a big believer in the aggression argument. I think I've known athletes on tons, and I mean tons, of testosterone, tons of androgens, who were as mellow as if they were on Valium. I've known athletes who have been on one shot a week who were complete assholes and off the chart. I just think what tends to happen with an androgenic drug is that, you know, if you're a guy who's a bit of an asshole, you're a guy who's a bit short-tempered, you're going to become a bigger asshole, and you're going to become more short-tempered. But if you're kind of mellow, it's not going to turn somebody who's mellow into, you know, a guy who's going out looking to fight with everybody who, like, stops too short at a red light and he can't get through the intersection. It just, I think, varies from person to person. I think that's overplayed. At the end of the day, an androgenic drug is taken for strength and muscle mass. No, you're not going to gain a lot of muscle mass in a short period of time if you're using it. But the strength gains are going to be more apparent more quickly.
Gotcha. Tom, did you have an opportunity to see Anderson's legal counsel there? He's actually a very good lawyer, but he just seemed – his name is Michael Alonzo. Did you have a chance to watch the hearing in depth or
No, I didn't. I mean, I've just been reading about it, but I will take a look at this Michael Alonzo guy.
Yeah, I mean, I checked out his credentials. I mean, a law degree from the University of Southern California. He's big in gaming and, lobbyist in bed with casinos. He's out of Reno. But I thought he looked like a guy that might have graduated law school yesterday. Seemed lost at times. He brought this clown, Paul Scott. I mean, Larry, what did you think of this guy, Paul Scott, who the commission thought he was a doctor, and he had to correct him and say, no, I have a BS and a JD from Europe or something.
Right, and he apparently worked at USADA, but when he worked at USADA, it was, from what I've been told, he was working on like contracts. So how is he there as a qualified doping expert? I mean, you might as well have gotten the janitor at USADA, right?
So wait a minute. This guy was like he was like a secretary or something like that.
I think he worked more like in a legal capacity at USADA, but that doesn't mean you know anything about actual doping.
Yeah.
So he got discredited completely. And Brian, let me just say this to you: I don't know anything about Anderson's lawyer. Don't know. Don't care. Here's what I know: a first year law student would have been laughed out of the classroom with this defense. And would have failed the course if the teacher was aware that they had the argument sitting in their pocket that something was wrong with these lab results. Like, listen, at the end of the day, do I think that Anderson thought he was taking liquid, you know, sex enhancers? No, I don't. I don't think that's credible at all. Do I think that he got caught with stuff in his system that, you know, especially with respect to the justanolone? Justanolone doesn't exist in the human body unless you place it there. Do I think it mistakenly got there? No, I don't. So I guess what I'm saying in a long-winded way is I think he did exactly what he's accused of doing. That said, the burden is on the state. The burden is on the state of Nevada to prove that Anderson Silva doped. And I think a first-year law student would say, hey, wait a second. Quest did a test minutes apart, and he's clean. So we're going to walk in there, we being Anderson's team. We're going to walk in there, and we're going to say, well, with all due respect, you have the burden of proving he used, and you're going to hold up the Smyrtle test result. However, within minutes, he gave a sample to Quest, and he's negative. So how do we know, Commission? How do we know beyond, forget about a reasonable doubt, how do we even know 51% that he had this in his system because the lab tested him positive at the same time that another lab that, oh, by the way, you hired. So you must have thought that Quest was a credible lab to do drug testing. And, oh, by the way, how many times have you, Nevada State Athletic Commission, used Quest for drug testing? Hundreds of times. So you obviously have faith in them. And their test, he's clean. Now, they would have responded and said, well, let's forget about the 31st for a minute. He was still dirty on the 9th. But who tested him dirty on the 9th? Smyrtle. So you can still try to discredit the result based on, hey, wait a second. Maybe if you'd have had Quest test Anderson on the 9th, he would have been clean then too. So maybe there's something up with the Smyrtle test. And then your last piece of evidence is that the other main event fighter got conflicting drug test results from these same two labs on the same night. So something doesn't seem definitive. That should have been their defense, not a backroom deal for an unmarked vial of liquid from a guy who just got back from Thailand.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds a lot more – it sounds like something you can actually buy. And then you could also introduce into evidence, well, how about the test on the 18th that Anderson passed? That was Smyrtle, correct?
Correct. That was also Smyrtle.
So as far as I know, Quest never came back with a positive result for anabolics.
Correct.
Only for the benzos.
Oh, I don't think Quest tested the benzos. Again, I'm working off of the one page of his drug test from Quest, and it says anabolic agents negative, masking agents negative. There is no reference on the page I have to them testing for the benzos. Smyrtle, I believe, tested him positive for the benzos.
Now, Tom, I mean, as a fighter, if you're facing a guy that was just, you know, popping Xanax, you know, because I had another fighter tell me that he would take Xanax to basically knock him out, because when he was cutting weight, you know, it was torture. So if he could sleep it off, that'd be 5 or 6 hours that he wasn't suffering. And he was still losing weight. So, I mean, is taking benzos out of competition, what's your take on that? Is that bad?
I don't care if the guy's fighting. Like, you're asking me from the perspective of, if I'm fighting an opponent that's been doing that, I don't really care.
Right.
You know, I mean, I guess I could see where the benefit would lie, but you would get just as much benefit, you know, doing other things compared to doing the drugs. So
Larry, I'm not sure that I believe Anderson that he only took the benzos the night before the fight. I mean, they get out of your system pretty quick.
Yeah, they do. I mean, you know, I think what's also kind of an interesting side note from the hearing is that there was almost no discussion of the Andrustane positive, and there was really little discussion of the benzo positive. It seemed like they were really focused on the Dristanolone, and I'm not exactly sure why.
I think one of Michael Alonso's first statements was, you know, where he said basically, we're not arguing with you on the benzos, and we don't have anything for you on the Andrustane.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. You know?
And then he just wanted to attack the Dristanolone with this infamous clear blue vial, which...
Which is fine, Brian, but why is the commission saying, oh, okay, that's fine, like when they're giving their sentence, which was another joke, and I've seen it written about, like, oh, they really, you know, this really hurt Anderson with his penalty. Really? Because I thought he was going to get 12 months from day one. I said that when I came on with you last time. So what? Best case was he was going to get 9 months. So poor Anderson is going to be out for 3 extra months because he got up there and had this ludicrous, unbelievable, defies any sense of logic defense, when he had another defense sitting in his pocket that at a minimum, if he used the conflicting result defense, at a minimum, it's cutting him down to 9 months and it's cutting down his penalty. And look, you know, we can all say, oh, wow, you know, 380 grand, that's a lot of money. It's not a lot of money for an Anderson Silva who, you know, Brian, his reported income is very different than what he actually makes.
He's not stepping in the cage for less than $5 million.
Okay, so like best case you could make is they took 10% of his money overall. Right, 380 grand, that would mean he had 3.8 million. That's the best case you can make. That is not a harsh penalty, especially when the commission is sitting there for the bulk of the hearing, basically almost laughing at him and saying, yeah, this really just isn't believable. Like, did it occur to you? I know one commissioner, I think it was Marnell, said, did it occur to you it wasn't a good idea to take, you know, a liquid from an unmarked vial from a guy that, you know, you knew from a year from the gym? No, it didn't occur to me. Like, the defense was laughable. So what was the real penalty aside from public shame of making, like, a fool out of himself at this hearing? Aside from legacy, but you could argue that a lot of that was going to take a hit to some degree. What was the real hard additional penalty? 3 extra months? Really? Wow.
Why didn't he just say, hey, I was having trouble cutting weight, and I took this stuff?
You know what he should have done, honestly? And it always it blows my mind, like, when it comes to athletes, and it's not just MMA athletes. We see it in baseball. We see it in football. Okay. One guy, and I'm going to ask you guys if you can name him. He's not from MMA. One guy has basically walked scot-free when he got caught doping. Any guesses?
Well, what sport? Maybe that'll...
Baseball.
Mm.
3 seconds.
Andy Pettit?
Correct. And what did Andy Pettit do?
He said, I needed it because I was coming off an injury, and I took growth hormone. It was in that senator from New England's report, the Mitchell report.
Yeah. So Andy Pettit, when he got caught, Instead of – now, do I believe that Andy Pettit took one shot of human growth hormone? If so, he's probably the only human being in history that's only taken one shot of HGH who took HGH. But it was a great story. Hey, I was injured. I was – he used the I wanted to get back to my team nobility defense. You know, I wanted to get back and be with my teammates and help them win. I made a bad decision. I was trying to expedite my healing. I took a shot. I was wrong. I apologize. 2 weeks later, nobody brought up Andy Pettit again. People are still talking about Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Lance Armstrong. Why? Because it's the aftermath. It's not the thing. And if Anderson, quite frankly, like if Anderson had come to me, which of course he never has, and I don't expect him to after this, but if he had ever, if he had come to me when this happened and said, what do I do? I would have written a paragraph that basically said something to the effect of, listen, go back and look at the video. My leg is swinging from the bottom of my knee like a piece of rope. I was in massive pain. I wasn't afraid I wasn't going to fight again. I was afraid I wasn't going to walk again. I was afraid that I wasn't going to have a life riddled with pain for the rest of my life. So when people came to me and offered me different things, I wasn't even logically thinking. I would have taken anything that I thought could help me because I was afraid for the quality of the remainder of my life. Forget about MMA. Because you look at Corey Hill, he said he had pain the rest of his life. You'll know Brian, I don't follow it as closely, but there was a wrestler, I believe, who had a similar injury where he like decimated the lower part of his leg.
Sid Vicious.
Right. He said he was in pain the rest of his life. So, hey, I'm Anderson Silva. I'm 39. I busted this leg horribly. And I took 30 different supplements. And which supplement, the Drostanolone or the Androstane, was in, I don't have a clue. I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm not going to put anybody through trying to figure this all out. Give me my penalty. I apologize. But if you put yourself in my position for a minute, I was concerned about the rest of my life. I wasn't concerned about getting back in a cage. And I took tons of supplements, and I have no idea why I tested positive, but I accept whatever penalty you want to bring my way.
Sure. And this, I want to ask Tom, in a more of a general sense, Tom, have you seen – have you looked around, you know, the weigh-ins, some of the fights, or the fight that you participated in Chicago, and said, yeah, it's pretty obvious things have changed. You know, these rules are scaring people.
I don't know that I really have to the degree that I would have thought. You know, you see a few people with different body types, but I don't know if it's that I wasn't looking previously, you know, in the past, just looking at everybody and going like, oh, he might have been on something. He might not have been on something, but I don't know. I thought I was going to notice it a lot more, to be honest.
How about you, Larry?
Well, I'm starting to notice it, but keep in mind, Tom, it's still early. I mean, you know, we're only 6 weeks into this thing. Let's take a look at what everybody looks like 3 or 4 months from now, when whatever they may have been on is really fully out of their system. I mean, the only thing that's going to stay in your system longer than that are the heavy oils like decadurabolin and equipoise, because they can actually stay in the body for 18 to 24 months. Wow. And it's going to get interesting if somebody tests positive for one of those, because I'm sure USADA will slam them, and that's fine, but it doesn't mean that they were on it now. That stuff stays in the system a long time. So if you're a fighter, and quite frankly, if you're a fighter and you've had any kind of advice from anybody, those are the last two substances anyone would put you on, because they just live in the body way too long to pass even, you know, the simplest of drug tests. But the rest of the stuff, you know, the testosterones, the strength enhancers, the drostanolones, all these drugs that, you know, can, a lot of them are in and out quickly, but a lot of them take a couple of months to exit. I think by the end of the year is when we'll really look and go, wow, that guy looks a lot different than he did 6 months ago. I think right now it's a little too soon to tell.
What's your take on the IV ban? Can they even enforce it?
I don't know how you enforce it. I think it's ridiculous. I mean, look, if you're going to do an IV ban, then I think you can't do weigh-ins 24 hours out. Because as long as the weigh-in is that far out, guys are going to cut massive amounts of weight. Women are going to cut massive amounts of weight for their body type, depending on the female. I think it's a terrible idea. I think when you really – I found a study out of Australia where they did – it was a very small sample, so that was the flaw in the study if you want to criticize it. But they took six – I believe it was soccer athletes, and they did MRIs on their brains before and after they lost, get this, 2.5% of their body weight. So that's like a 200-pound fighter cutting to 195, right? Okay, which is nothing, right? Like, Tom, when you were fighting at middleweight, how many pounds were you generally cutting to make weight?
Usually about 15 to 20 the week of.
Okay, so you're looking at about, let's just say for argument's sake, 10% of a drop in weight. This is a 2.5% drop in weight. And they showed a direct correlation on the MRI with potential brain damage on impact because there's so much less cushioning around the brain. So I think anything that frustrates the rehydration process, and here's the thing. If you're USADA, I get that, like, when you go and you regulate Olympic sport by congressional mandate versus a combat sport or it, quite frankly, a promotion, not the sport, by contract, you have a lot more power with a congressional mandate. So you can write this USADA code, which if you want to get into, Brian, there are aspects of this code that are shocking that I think most fighters don't even know are in there. But you can write it however you want it because at the end of the day, you have all the leverage. Now, they put this IV ban in because athletes who weren't really dehydrated were using IV hydration as a masking technique. That's not what any fighter is doing. So to me, to take away IV hydration but leave the weigh-in 24 hours out is medically irresponsible to the fighters completely. And you're doing it for a purpose that doesn't line up. You have the right. Let's say it's Tom. You can test Tom 27 times in the 10 days before and after the fight if you want to. You can test him on fight night. You can test him at the weigh-in. You can test him after the weigh-in. You can test him the next day after the fight. You have that power. I have no problem with that. So do you really need to ban IV rehydration to make sure Tom isn't masking? Because when you have the power to test him as often as you want to, you're going to catch him if you suspect him anyway. After he hydrates, the drug isn't getting out of his system in 4 hours. So when you have a technique at your disposal that causes no harm to the fighter potentially, and you insist on using this stupid ban on a technique that allows a fighter to properly rehydrate so there is cushioning around his or her brain, then you're just being ignorant. And you have not regulated a sport where fighters are, or athletes are, allowed to punch, kick, and elbow their opponent in the skull. So I think you have to take a step back and say, okay, wait, we know the IV ban makes sense in cycling. We know it makes sense in swimming or whatever the hell else you regulate. But it really makes no sense in a sport like this. And the fact that they're still pushing forward with this thing truly boggles my mind. And it's going to get somebody or multiple people, in my opinion, severely, severely hurt in the cage.
Now, Larry, do you know Olympic boxers, can they use an IV?
Under USADA, no. It's still a prohibited method under USADA. So if USADA regulates your sport, you can't use an IV. Now, however, Brian, let's keep one thing in mind. It's still terrible. Still a terrible idea. But a couple of things. Number one, boxing has about 97 weight classes the last time I checked. So you don't get people dropping 20 and 30 pounds like you do in MMA because the weight divisions are 3, 4, 5 pounds apart in many cases. Number two, and perhaps more importantly, boxers are using big padded gloves in comparison to an elbow, in comparison to a knee, in comparison to a shin. So I could argue that perhaps the impact isn't as great. The flip side is that boxers get punched in the head way more than MMA fighters, so the brain has more of an opportunity to rattle around in there. So take it as six on one hand and half a dozen on the other, but if it's regulated by USADA, you can't use an IV regardless of the sport.
Now, the one argument against that, the one argument that people are bringing up, that they're saying that USADA is correct in not allowing the IVs, is the biological passport. Mm-hmm. And I know it's been successful with catching some cyclists. I don't really know I can't tell you a good definition of what a biological passport is, but apparently it has caught some people who have passed blood tests, urine tests. So is that the only reason why they want the IVs banned?
Here's how I look at it, Brian and Tom. I look at it that, you know, when you're making a decision that impacts the health and safety of other human beings, you have to take the benefit, the positive of that decision, and put it on one side of the scale. And you have to put the foreseeable negative consequences of that decision and put it on the other side of the scale. And I don't care about biological passports. I don't care about IV rehydration and when using it as a masking agent. At the end of the day, when the negative side of the scale is potential brain damage and injury to the brain of these athletes that go in there and lay it all on the line, I don't care what's on the other side of the scale.
Tom, what's your take on the IVs? And tell us, in Chicago, how did you rehydrate? You know, like Brian Stan was talking about, you know, the old-fashioned way, or did you IV it?
I've never used an IV in my career. I don't have any problem with the IV ban at all. And after the weigh-ins, I rehydrated the old-fashioned way, food, water.
So you went 206, and when you entered the cage, you were 203, if I remember correct. Remember, Tom, I was drinking that weekend pretty aggressively. So what did you get up to when you walked in the cage?
Probably about 215. That's what I had cut from initially. I just like way overcut. I don't know if it's because I was sweating because I had on all that Reebok gear or what the deal was, but.
You did have quite a bit of Reebok gear on.
Yeah, yeah. So each layer, I'm sure, was taken off, you know, a tenth of a pound here and there. So, I got down to 203 when I should have been, you know, 205, 206. But the weight cut wasn't very hard. And in the past, I've had some really hard weight cuts. I just, I don't know, there's something about sticking the IV into my bloodstream that I'm not enticed about.
You know, the other thing, Larry, I mean, there's a pretty popular guy in the UFC scene. He actually works for the UFC. He's a cut man. And he gives the guys IVs. I know of one friend of mine who received one from him. And he does this to a lot of fighters, and he charges them money for it. Mm-hmm. And he has a documented history of being completely negligent in his job as a paramedic. And I'm like, my God, I was in that room when my friend was getting an IV from this guy. I don't know where the fuck that needle's been. I mean,
right.
You know, and that's when I was like, oh, shit. You know, maybe. But you're saying that the IV thing, you if you were making the call, it would still be allowed.
If I were making the call, I think you have to do one or the other. I think you either have to leave the IV in place, and it's great that Tom doesn't use it, but you know there's a lot of athletes who do. Okay? Sure. And let's be honest, like let's say you get sick, you're throwing up, you get dehydrated, you go to an ER. Do they give you an IV or do they give you a glass of water? So IV is clearly proven medically to be more effective at rehydration in a short period of time. Now, I'm all for an IV ban if you make the weigh-in right before they fight. Because then if you dehydrate 20 pounds and you're going to step in the cage an hour later, you're a dope. and that's on you. But the way the system is set up, I think you have to be honest. Athletes are going to do things that are not always medically in their best interest to compete at the highest level. And if you have a structure in place that has weigh-ins 24 to 28, 29 hours before somebody's actually going to step in the cage, they're going to drop a lot of weight in most cases. And when they do, if you take away the IV rehydration, for a lot of athletes, that's going to spell a big negative. There's going to be guys like Tom that it won't matter to. There's going to be plenty of those. But there's 600 fighters on this roster. And I'd be shocked if a third of them didn't use IV rehydration. So, yeah, you know, I think you can't have it both ways, I guess is what I'm saying. Either move the weigh-in or allow them to IV rehydrate.
It's interesting you mentioned more weight classes. And in boxing, you know, there are 18 weight classes from 105 up to heavyweight.
Okay, so not the 97 I thought it was. My mistake.
Well, yeah, but sometimes they make up weights, you know, the Mayweather weight, right. The Pacquiao weight. And it's interesting because Joe Rogan was talking about the same thing, that he thinks they should be 10 pounds apart, you know, once you start getting up to 185, 195, 205. And I don't know, but it kind of sounded like Joe might have known something.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward. I mean, the one that obviously jumps off the page is heavyweight, right? I mean, if you're 207 pounds in a non-title fight, you can fight someone who's 266. Yep. It would seem to me like the first thing you would do is put like a cruiserweight, you know, somewhere in the middle, 35 or something like that. Some of the weight ranges are obviously pretty big. But I don't know how that would work, Brian, because a lot of the divisions are not overloaded with talent as it is. And now if you're going to cut the division in half, you know, like how good is each of those divisions going to be now? I don't know.
Tom, what do you think about the prospect of adding more weight classes?
Well, I was going to interfere here and say that, you know, I can't say that you would know that Joe Rogan knows anything because, like, this would have to go through the ABCs first. This wouldn't be the UFC making the call.
Right,
obviously,
right.
You know, obviously they play some role lobbying.
Tom, if I could just interject for 1 second, you can correct me if I'm wrong, Larry. I thought several years ago ABC did recommend to do 165, 175, 185, 195. Do you remember that?
I do not.
No?
I'm not saying it didn't happen.
Okay, then go ahead then. Maybe I'm thinking of something else.
No, I mean, you know, that could be the case. But, you know, it would have to be them making the call, not necessarily the UFC.
But I don't know about that. Elite XC made a Nick Diaz division.
Yeah.
I think it's up to the promoter, right, Larry?
You know, I'm not – I don't want to say I'm sure either way. My guess is that if a promoter as big as the UFC went to the ABC and said, hey, you know, we'd like to add these two divisions, I don't see them getting a fight on it.
Yeah.
Right? Because at the end –
I guess eventually it would probably come down to the actual commission – because everyone has to sanction the fight. So maybe that's, you know, not even the ABC. Maybe it boils down to just whatever commission is sanctioning the individual card.
So let's say, Tom, there's a division 85, 95, 205.
Yeah.
Do you think that's too much? Cause, I mean, I would think that you could fight at 95.
Yeah, I could definitely fight at 95. 185 is just, you know, it's too far down at this point in my life. I don't know. I don't think it's a good idea. Maybe adding the cruiserweight or you know, something along those lines. My opinion falls more along with Larry's. With, you know, the divisions just aren't stacked enough at this point. You know, like 155 is loaded with talent. 170 is loaded with guys. So those two divisions could be okay being, but the rest of them, you know, not so much. So maybe a 165 and then like a 175. You know, and then a 200, a 225, and then heavyweight. You know, shift them around a little, not necessarily just add them every 10 pounds, but.
Gotcha. Yeah, and just to switch gears a little bit from, you know, from all this PED and weight-related topic, I know, Larry, you've been very outspoken of late regarding pay-per-view bias for the UFC. And let me preface this by saying, you know, the leading guy for the reporting pay-per-views is Dave Meltzer, Wrestling Observer. That's a guy I've been reading since I was 10 years old, you know, and I'm 32 now. So I'm a Dave Meltzer guy. I love reading his stuff. So, you know, it's not like I'm going after him but I think a lot of those numbers that have been put out there of late are on the high side. And I know that you had a similar opinion, and I wanted to hear the reasons why you thought that.
Yeah, and listen, this isn't personal to anybody. I like Dave too, but you know, at the end of the day, UFC 189 was the one that jumped off the page to me. I don't pay a ton of attention to pay-per-view buys. Like, I don't sit there waiting and analyzing and all that. It's not really my thing. That's Dave's thing. And it's some other media people's thing. But when I saw the numbers for 189, it made no sense to me. The UFC put on their website that Conor McGregor, in his bio, that UFC 189, that Conor McGregor basically proved his popularity because UFC 189 did 1 million buys. And that struck me because, first off, so many MMA websites just parroted what they said and said, you know, UFC 189 does 1 million. And Dave came out with an estimate, I believe 950 was the lowest number I heard from him. Someone else told me 1 million. So in the same range, 950 to 1 million. And the thing that really kind of struck me was that the prelims only did 847,000 buys. Now, let me say flat out, I am no pay-per-view expert, but I know how to do math. And the idea that more people paid for the pay-per-view than watched the prelims for free struck me as impossible. So what I did, because again, it's not something I follow, not something I analyze on a regular basis, I went back to the beginning of the year, and I went from 182 forward, and I looked up what the prelims did on each card, and what the pay-per-view numbers were reported to be on each card. Because I thought, hey, I don't pay attention to stuff. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this happens all the time. Maybe it's not that unusual. Well, it's not only unusual, it hasn't happened this entire year. Now, I will confess, I have better things to do than spending 5 or 6 hours going back and researching every pay-per-view versus the prelim in history. But I did look at this whole year, and this year, just to give you an idea, and let me say this too. The reason I put a lot of credence in the prelim numbers is because nobody with a marketing incentive or an axe to grind actually reports those numbers. The people who report television numbers couldn't care less whether 8 people watched, 847, or 847,000. It doesn't matter to them because they're not selling advertising. They're not trying to push Conor McGregor as bigger than Brock Lesnar. So when I looked at the prelim numbers this year versus the pay-per-view buys, so as an example, let's say that 1 million people watched the prelims and 500,000 people bought the pay-per-view. I put that as a 50% buy rate. Okay? Make sense?
Sure.
All right. So I went back to the beginning of the year with Jones DC, which I still think was the most anticipated card of the year. I think Jones Cormier, if you go back and remember how much hate was coming into that fight and them getting caught on the hot mic at ESPN, them fighting in the lobby of the MGM, I think that anticipation exceeded McGregor Mendez. But they did a 77% buy rate. So they had a little over 1 million watch the prelims. They had 800,000 buy. The rest of the year, Demetrius Johnson Haraguchi was the outlier on the negative side. They had 710,000 watch the prelims and 125 watch the pay-per-view. So they were only 18%. Every other card this year was between 31 and 49%. McGregor Mendez, if you believe those numbers, is 118%. So it's not an outlier. It's an outlier that's 41 points above the next closest outlier.
Wow.
So then I thought, okay, wait, let's be fair. I want to be thorough. I went back and I looked at some of the bigger fights that I thought, well, maybe Lesnar. Maybe Lesnar fights were like this. So I went back and looked at Lesnar-Kane. That was 60%. 1.5 million down to 900,000 buys. So that was 60. I looked at GSP Shields. That was 53%. Then I thought, all right, maybe it's grudge matches. So the two grudge matches that most stand out to me are Evans Rampage at 114, and they did 63%. And, of course, your friend Chael Sonnen versus Anderson Silva, too. I still think that's the biggest grudge match that I've been a party to. 51%. 1.8 million watched the free. 925,000 bought the pay-per-view. So, to me, it was ludicrous when I can't find another card that is above 77%, and you're telling me this was 118%. And ironically, a couple of days later, the UFC removed the $1 million number from their website, and Meltzer downgraded his estimate, I believe, to 800 to 850, which I still think is a high number. I mean, if I apply the 77% that Jones-Cormier did to McGregor-Mendez based on the prelims, and I'm not saying it's perfect math, but it gives us an idea. If I apply the highest number I could find to McGregor-Mendez, it comes out at 650 or 652, I believe. That's a great number. For a featherweight fight with a short-notice opponent, that's a great number. To me, that proves McGregor has like some real drawing power. But a million?
Yeah.
Mathematically just doesn't make any sense.
And you know, Larry, I have another theory. When they put that 1 million number up on the website, I think they got some calls from managers saying, hey, this did a million buys. You know, so what's, you know, there were other guys with pay-per-view cuts on
right.
there. And those guys have audit rights. You know, if you have a good manager, you can put audit rights in there, and they're okay with it.
And Brian, let's not forget about, I believe it was 2012 or 2013, Rampage Jackson gave an interview, and I know he's always bitter with somebody, but he gave an interview, and he said that the UFC lies about pay-per-view numbers. He said that they specifically told him one number and then publicly put a different number out, and that he wanted to be paid on the number that they put out, and that these are his words. You can Google it. I mean, he did this interview, and he said very specifically that they told him, no, those are just the numbers we give to the media. This is the real number, and he would not get paid on the bigger number. So listen, who knows what they do? Maybe it was a mistake, but what kind of struck me was how quickly the majority of the media will just accept something. Like, look, again, I don't follow pay-per-views. I don't look at these numbers ever, but when you're telling me the prelims did 847 and the pay-per-view did a million, don't you logically take a step back for a second and go, has that ever happened? Have more people actually paid for the card than watched the prelims for free? Because it seems counterintuitive, right? I mean, it seems like, hey, it's on free, lots of people watch, and then a percentage of those people say, yeah, I want to keep watching. That's why they usually make the last fight on the free card a fight they think is going to deliver, because they want people to be excited and carry over into the pay-per-view. Makes sense. But the idea that more than one person went and bought the pay-per-view, I joked with a friend of mine, I said, to believe this number, you have to believe that like three people are sitting in the living room watching the prelims and they all go home and buy the pay-per-view separately. Like, it just didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. And the latest that I had heard from Dave was he said new estimate was like 800,000, but it would take about 2 to 3 months to get a more solid figure. And that 800,000 figure could be 20% off either way.
And just, you know, just if we do that math, if the 20% is on the downside, what number are we at? 640. Which is almost exactly the 77% that Jones-Cormier did. If you apply that 77% to McGregor-Mendez, it comes out to 652. So if he's right and it adjusts down 20%, we're basically right at the same place. And the thing to me is, it's a great place to be. Like, for Conor McGregor to sell 640,000 pay-per-views, I don't think he's the draw everyone says he is. I think he's a star. I get it. But to compare him to Lesnar and GSP to me is silly. But 650,000 pay-per-views for a featherweight fight? Has there ever been a featherweight fight that did 300?
I think Aldo and Edgar did three and a quarter, but that also had Overeem.
So that's half.
That had Overeem's return.
Right, but that's half. I mean, imagine you double the best featherweight title, the best featherweight fight in history, ratings-wise. You double the first time you headline a pay-per-view. That makes you a star. You're a star. Yeah. Why do we have to pretend that the number is so much greater than that? Because you've been pushing this narrative that Conor is bigger than GSP and Brock. So 650 is not acceptable because Lesnar would have spit on 650. Lesnar would have done 650 beating me up.
I think okay? It comes down to people want to see bigger numbers because I think, and I've talked about this before, a lot of people within this MMA bubble, they have this inferiority complex that we're not accepted by the mainstream. And if we put up these huge numbers, then we'll somehow gain acceptance into the mainstream. And my go-to line has always been, well, what is so cool about the mainstream? Do you know the Kardashians are mainstream? Are they cool? Not my opinion.
And listen, I think there's a pretty strong, again, mathematical, I'm not a pay-per-view, but just math. I think there's a pretty strong argument when you look at the Spike days and you look at the numbers that Spike was pulling in on Fight Night cards. I think the last five Fight Night cards on Spike, if you go back and look, the average was close to 2 million a card. Now, on FS1, I think the only card that's even come close was the debut card with Chael and Shogun. I think it did 1.8 or something in that range.
Right.
So, and when you look at most of the FS1 cards, they're nowhere near 2 million. Like, not even in the neighborhood. So isn't there an argument, like, you look at the UFC's best pay-per-view years, you look at the UFC's best free TV years, it was all pre-Fox. And I think you could make a pretty strong argument that if mainstream is judged by ratings, then you were more mainstream before you went mainstream.
I agree with you on that. I think the UFC was more mainstream when they were on Spike because UFC was the only game in town for Spike. You know, Spike was basically the UFC channel. Now UFC's on Fox, and it's kind of like, you know, hey, it's just another one of our properties. We got a lot of them.
Right. I mean, I remember when, you know, in the Spike days, I mean, God, you couldn't put Spike on for 3 hours and not see a UFC event, a replay of a UFC event, the highlight type shows that they did, the
what was
countdown
that?
Shows.
Did you say Cops?
Yeah, or Cops.
Right. Right. When those are your only two programs for the UFC, I think that was a great thing because it was tremendous exposure for the brand.
Yeah, sure. Hey, Tom, you got anything in closing for Larry?
No, informative as always. I'm kind of an idiot when it comes to this stuff and don't really understand it.
Well, once you start getting the pay-per-view cut, you win three or four more fights.
Okay, not that stuff. I'm talking about the steroid talk, Brian.
Oh.
PED stuff.
Let's be clear.
I understand about boner pills, but I don't get the actual steroid jargon, so... you know, it helps enlighten me. Like we were talking about that, Brian. You know, I figure the less I know, the less tempted I'm going to be to use anything. So,
yeah, that might be a good attitude because you know, if you know a lot about it and you know what it can do, it might be tempting. And if you get caught in this era, you're fucking done.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, Brian, that's something. Just as a corollary on the Anderson thing, keep in mind that. Not only do I think the commission went soft, pun intended, on Anderson, but they are 2 months away, I believe. I think September is when they want to put their new rules in, where this offense as a first offense would have been 36 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just something you can't take any stuff now. I mean,
no.
Unless you get the most sophisticated, you know, this microdosing or pro hormones, you know, I mean, this is stuff you know about that I've only heard about. I mean,
unless Brian, if you take a close look at USADA, if you're really smart and you want to game the system like what Anderson could have done, if USADA had applied, is just retire. Because if you retire, you're not subject to their testing. And then if you decide that you want to come back, you have to give them 4 months' notice. So basically, as long as you clean out before you tell them that you want to come back, you're good. And then there's a provision that says you have to notify them 4 months before returning unless the UFC waives it.
Which they probably would.
So that's pretty fascinating because you and I know, like, fights fall out all the time. There's a lot of talk behind the scenes. Could the UFC say, hey, we got to put Anderson in because we lost so-and-so in this fight, so we're going to waive the 4 months? Now, he'd still get tested, but then he, in that circumstance, would not have to undergo testing for the full 4 months coming into the fight. So it is kind of an interesting little thing. It's in Article 5. And last but not least, Tom, take this as my gift, but you should take a close look at Article 10 because it says that bout results can be overturned if you fail. That's fine. You can forfeit your ranking, your purse, or title. Fine. And then it says UFC may also impose a fine up to $500,000.
Wow.
Which is stunning to me. Like, I doubt a lot of fighters are aware. Did you know that was in there?
No, I did not.
Okay. Now, just let me just play this out for fun for a second. I would argue that Jose Aldo is probably not the most popular guy at the UFC offices. Would you agree?
Oh yeah.
I agree.
Okay. And Jose Aldo has already come out and said, yeah, screw you with your IV rehydration. I'm rehydrating with an IV whether you like it or not. Right?
Yep.
So let's say that there's some evidence somehow that Jose Aldo rehydrated with his IV. That means he violated the USADA code. That means under this provision, the UFC could fine him $500,000. That's pretty stunning.
Wow.
And keep in mind, there's guys who make 10 and 10 who could get fined $500,000. So it is a little startling when you read that provision.
Yeah. Tom, I know you guys had a conference call. A lot of the fighters and they call it the fight support personnel, which I guess is a fancy word for manager, had to call into this conference call on Wednesday in Colorado. What did you take from it? You know, was there anything?
I wasn't on it.
Oh, okay.
It was like it was scheduled during time when I'm training. I was at the gym, so I didn't make it out to catch it. But I will tell you this: that the
Tom, there's another one on Wednesday. Yeah, but actually, you'll be on vacation, so
I'll be in Alaska. If I'm doing nothing, maybe I'll jump on. I may be driving at that point up to like a park or something, so maybe I can jump on there. Yeah, like there's not a whole lot. I think most of the info that they probably went over is on the website because they basically just directed people to that if they can't get on to the conference call. I'm not sure why they only have two of them and they sent out the info like 2 days before, but oh well.
Yeah, that was interesting. But they do have a pretty comprehensive website, like you said.
From the interaction I've had with Jeff Nowitzki, he seems very eager to help anyone that's trying to get more information or trying to find out what the deal is with this testing policy. So, it's pretty easy to reach out to him and get an answer on what you want.
Now, Larry, isn't this Nowitzki the guy that went after Barry Bonds for a decade and they ended up with his punishment was 3 months locked in his 25,000-foot mansion in Beverly Hills?
Yeah, listen, Nowitzki is a very aggressive guy when it comes to drugs. He didn't only go after Bonds. He was like, I think, at the heart of the Lance Armstrong case for years. I mean, he has a great reputation as far as being an anti-drug guy. I don't have any issue with him with that. What I have an issue with is that I think you have to be a bit more sensitive to the sport you're regulating. So in the case of the IV thing, which I know he's going around and doing talks and telling everybody, it's done. You can rehydrate just the same by drinking water or not cutting as much weight. I just think you have to kind of step out of the bubble of the USADA code and say, who are we dealing with? What are their risk factors if we enforce this one provision when we have 10 different ways to test them as often as we want, whenever we want, wherever we want, to make sure that they're not doping? So That's my only issue where he's concerned.
All right, that's Larry Pepe. Larry, how do you how do people find you on Twitter and listen to? Man, it's got to be one of the longest running MMA podcasts because I was listening to it in 08 or 09.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, we've been around for over 7 years now. And you can catch the show at prommaradio.com online. And if you are a member of the American Forces or living with a member of the American Forces in any of the 170 countries that the Voice Network goes into, which is their biggest network, we're also their official radio show, so you can listen to it on Saturdays at 5 p.m. if you're in the service. And last but not least, my Twitter, at Larry Pepe, last four letters, P-E-P-E.
Now, are you also do some work with Fox Sports Radio? Because I've heard you on there before.
Right. I was with them for 2 years, and then I decided that I didn't want to do it anymore. Yeah, so I did their national broadcast for 2 years when they did the simulcasts of the events, and that was fun. But really, when I got into it with Fox, the idea was that, you know, we were going to build something that was going to be more extensive on the radio side, and they didn't really ultimately want to devote that time and energy. They wanted to just keep doing these simulcasts. And to be honest, I never thought the simulcast idea was so great because this isn't the 40s and, you know, people aren't listening to their radio for the boxing match with, you know, Max Schmeling. So I thought it was cool to interact with the fans, like, after the fights, and it was cool to preview the fights. But I don't think people really listen to fights on the radio, you know. So I just went to them about 2 years in, and I said, listen, you know, I'm not interested in continuing to do this. And they asked me to finish out the year, which I did. And then at that point, they abandoned the whole thing on the radio side. So I guess my read that they didn't really want to do more on the radio side was right, because once I left, they abandoned it completely.
Well, I encourage everybody to follow Larry on Twitter. There's very few very independent media sources. You know, like, even my biases are very apparent. You know, I don't pretend to be any sort of journalist, if you will. Larry is incredibly independent in his analysis. And I think that's to be admired. There's not too many of you.
I appreciate that greatly. I really do.
Larry, appreciate the time as always, sir.
Anytime, guys.
All right. Thank you.
You got it, Tommy.
Take care.